Hey everyone, welcome back.
It's another Wink Wednesday and we're Yay. So excited.
But before we get started, let's just address a small elephant in the room. If you listened to our last episode, which hopefully you have, you may have been expecting us to be discussing the LGBTQI experiences in the incarceration system for today's episode.
Yeah. That was our mistake. Yeah. As you can probably see from our title, we're not covering that today. But don't worry, we will be covering the LGBTQI experiences later on in this season. All right, should we get started?
Yep, let's do it. I'm Bhavana.
And I'm Vendela. And this is Women's Health Incarcerated. So, I don't know about you, Bobs, but this topic that we're discussing today, it's been one of the most intriguing issues for me so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that because I feel like this was something that I hadn't thought about too much before this episode. And even the concept of jail care that we've been talking about, I just hadn't heard about that too much beforehand. But before I disclose too much about what jail care even is, why don't you introduce to our audience what exactly it is that we're covering? What is our primary question for today?
Well, what we're really trying to explore is, to what extent is the criminal, legal, and incarceration system relied on and responsible for providing adequate health care for incarcerated people? And we're going to be analyzing this question through the lens of reproductive justice, but to help us explore this topic further, we're calling in an expert.
If a pregnant woman feels safer in jail than she does in her life on the street, then that's problematic.
That is Dr. Carolyn Zuffrin. She's a medical anthropologist and an OBGYN specializing in family planning at Johns Hopkins University. She is also the director of the research group, Advocacy and Research on Reproductive Wellness of Incarcerated People. Dr. Zuffrin has worked extensively on reproductive health issues affecting incarcerated women, from providing clinical care in jail to research, policy, and advocacy. Her work is situated at the intersection of reproductive justice, healthcare, and mass incarceration, which she also examines in her book, Jail Care: Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars. And this concept of jail care is actually very important in our discussion today. So when we sat down to interview her, she helped us to understand where this concept really stemmed from.
And the fundamental question that sparked this research, which is, what does it mean to care in a space of punishment? And then secondarily, or at least stemming from all that, all these contradictions with this right to health care that an incarcerated person gains, just as most of their other rights are being stripped from them, and it's a right they gain that they don't have in the community. Contradictions in that, you know, for many people, jail was the only place where they accessed healthcare and that they were unable to access it in the community. Contradictions such as, you know, observing that some deputies actually showed tremendous kindness to incarcerated individuals. Many did not. I'm not saying it was uniform, but some did. And some healthcare providers whom you would expect to show compassion and care, many of them did not. So it was amid these contradictions that I sensed there was some bigger story going on about the role that jail and care plays in our society, specifically within the phenomenon of mass incarceration, which is a highly racialized, hierarchical phenomenon that is a legacy of slavery, Jim Crow segregation, and how care fits in with this.
I want to talk more about this contradiction of an incarcerated individual gaining the right to healthcare, you know, just as so many of their rights are being taken away from them. And I know we mentioned about this constitutional right to healthcare that incarcerated people have pretty frequently on this podcast.
Yeah. No, we definitely have. But I think it's a very necessary point to keep bringing up. And we also haven't gone too much in depth on what that constitutional right even means or how it came about.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. So, for some context, In 1976, the Supreme Court case Estelle v. Gamble established a constitutional right to healthcare for incarcerated individuals in America.
Mm-hmm, right. And they established this right or ruling because this case claimed that since incarcerated individuals are dependent on the correctional institution to meet all of their medical needs, not addressing these needs or, quote, deliberate indifference towards them is considered cruel and unusual punishment, which is unconstitutional due to the Eighth Amendment.
However, the Supreme Court didn't list what counts as a serious medical need. That's not their role. Nor did they explain what deliberate indifference means, although subsequent court cases have tried to clarify that. But because of the vagueness of these terms, the healthcare delivery system on the ground is highly variable. And this also reflects the variability and the lack of cohesiveness of our prison and jail systems. The fact that every Department of Corrections at the state level, and even within that, each individual prison at times can have their own policies, especially when it comes to healthcare, and then every jail as well.
So this variability in how care is actually being provided, although, you know, it's a constitutional right, suggests another contradiction.
Right.
And this variability in care can exist for many reasons, because there are no mandatory standards that both jails and prisons have to follow. And it's also voluntary compliance for a facility to be accredited as one that meets certain standards of healthcare.
Yeah.
There's also just a varied level of oversight across the board. And all of this means that, you know, there's very minimal accountability.
Exactly. And variability also exists between the different types of correctional facilities.
Right.
So I know a lot of what we've been covering on this podcast so far has been about prisons. And just to reiterate some of what distinguishes a prison from a jail, prisons are under state and federal jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. And even among the different kinds of prisons, there's varying levels of oversight. So typically with federal prisons, their policies, specifically their healthcare policies, are publicly available. But when we compare that to jails, which is what we're focusing on for today's episode, jails are under county or city jurisdiction. And unlike federal prisons, policies regarding health and healthcare inside jails can be much more difficult to access.
Jails are generally short-term holding places. If someone gets arrested, they go to jail first. They may only go to jail. They may get released after a few hours. The average length of stay in jails in the U.S. is 25 days. Some people may be there for months, usually not longer than a year, although occasionally that can happen. And jails are located within communities. They're located where people live, or at least where they get arrested. Because they're under local jurisdiction, usually county, sometimes city, we actually, you know, you would think there would be as many jails as there are counties in this country, and that's a good rough estimate, but we actually have no idea how many jails there are in this country. There are some good guesses, and the Bureau of Justice Statistics conducts their jail census periodically, but it's not necessarily inclusive of everything that counts as a jail. So there are roughly 3,000 jails, but we don't even know, and we certainly don't know where they're all located. So just that fact alone should give us pause in thinking about what healthcare might look like. If we don't even know how many jails there are, how do we know what healthcare looks like?
So when researching and conceptualizing this term, jail care, Dr. Suffren was really looking at a lot of the contradictions that exist in the relationship between incarceration and healthcare. And so now we're coming back to these contradictory observations of jail being a punitive and violent place, and yet pregnant women feeling safe there.
So I took care and did research among pregnant women who, you know, they weren't necessarily happy about being in jail, but they also felt like they were safer in jail than their precarious lives on the street corners, where they were felt threatened by the ever-present risk of violence, of being raped, of being otherwise assaulted or exploited, where they worried about not having access to prenatal care or to drug treatment. And again, it's not that they wanted to be in jail, but that jail came to be part of the safety net of their lives. And that is diagnostic of the failures of our broader society, because jail is not a good place. It is still a place of punishment and deprivation. And yet people could still feel like jail provided them with safety compared to the chaos of their lives.
Right. So I know your ethnographic research was conducted at the San Francisco County Jail. And considering how variable healthcare is across correctional facilities, do you think that this observation or all the observations that you've been making are more specific to the San Francisco County Jail?
That's a great question. And it's something I often wondered during my research and analysis of the data. And I want to be clear that the San Francisco jail is not a utopia. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of people who experience bad healthcare, who are assaulted, and who have negative feelings toward it. Everyone has some negative feelings for sure.
Right.
So I want to be clear, first of all, that I'm not saying the San Francisco jail is a utopia.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if this can happen in a city like San Francisco, which, you know, is one of the cities in our country with the most robust safety net, then there are a lot of failures. I will also add that, you know, I did this ethnographic field work about 8 years ago now, and it's still very relevant. I've subsequently done other research studies in different states, and as recently as 6 months ago, some interviewees have said similar things of like, I don't want to be in jail and it's awful and you're, you know, the food is terrible and you're demeaned, you're treated like you're nobody. And at the same time, I'm getting healthcare here. I'm getting plugged into addiction care. This is giving me a pause and I'm going to be able to start my life again. Or this is better care than I got when I was in the community. And these are people, you know, not in California.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't at all call that contradictory relationship with jail. I wouldn't call it universal. But I would say it's common enough.
Right.
When I've talked about this with other healthcare providers across the country or previously incarcerated people, it resonates with a lot of them.
So something that really stood out to me when we were doing this interview with Dr. Suffren was when she was talking about Kima and her whole story.
Yeah, me too.
A woman whom I call Kima, who had given birth to several children in her past, many of whom she gave birth to while she was in custody. She did not have parental rights of any of them. And the time that I came to know her, she gave birth while she was in jail. She went back to jail. She only had a week or two left of her sentence before she was going to go to a drug treatment program that was designed for mothers and babies. And in the interim, the plan was for her sister to take care of the baby.
And her story puts the more conceptual issues concerning an unjust system and its impacts on care into perspective.
Well, while she was in the hospital after giving birth, the social worker or the child protective services, as it's called, worker, discovered that her sister had an open CPS case and therefore did not allow the baby to go with the sister. And that in and of itself caused all kinds of trauma for Kima, who was already experiencing a lot of trauma from giving birth in custody. And so as Kima was trying to figure out someone else who could perhaps care for the baby so that the baby wouldn't go into foster care, the state regulation just continued. For no apparent reason, the Child Protective Services worker put what's called a police hold on the baby, meaning that Kima could no longer have the baby in her room. The only way she could see the baby was to go to the nursery, which, by the way, required her to be handcuffed to a wheelchair. And that's how she could interact with her baby, in a wheelchair in the nursery while she was handcuffed. And then it just continued. She was not reunified with her baby at the drug treatment program. She was unable, she had some difficulty getting there and she relapsed with substance use disorders. You know, we understand them to be chronic conditions that have relapsing dimensions to them. One relapse doesn't mean that you are not eligible for treatment, but it did mean that she couldn't go to this program for moms and babies, at least at that point. There was still an opening for her because it continued, but she was arrested again a few weeks later. And as I talked to her in this time of rearrest, I said, so who's taking care of your baby? And she said, oh, with my cousin, you know, and it had only been a few weeks, maybe it was 2 or 3 months, but certainly well within the window where she had time, you know, to work on gaining custody of this child and to raise this child. But she was so conditioned by these state systems that had always controlled what her motherhood could and could not be. And that's what she had seen growing up, that she said, you know what, I'm just going to try, I'll have another baby, and I just need to stay clean while the baby's born, and, you know, soon after it's born, and then I can do this.
And it's clear to me that when a pregnant woman is incarcerated, like Kima, there's a chance that she's receiving prenatal care that she wouldn't have been able to access outside of the system.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the incarceration system and other state systems are preventing her from actually being able to be a mother.
So she was conditioned to have this, I'll just try again, because that's what these state systems did to her conception of motherhood. They gave her no chance, no chance at all. And Kima was a Black woman, and, you know, she herself as a child was in foster care and moved from home to home.
Right. And it even makes me think about how this is something that is disproportionately experienced by Black, Native, and Latinx women.
Right.
And for many of these women, it isn't the first or only exposure to the state having control over one's family and ability to parent.
Yeah, and I actually looked into this more, but many of these incarcerated women of color have had involvement with Child Protective Services during their own childhood, whether it be through foster care or some other form of the state deciding where they live and who their parents are.
Right.
In fact, children placed in foster care are roughly 2 to 3 times more likely to be involved with the criminal legal system in adulthood. And just like with the incarceration system, Black children are overrepresented in the foster care system.
Mm-hmm.
So that state-level control is by no means new in adulthood. And even when we spoke to Dr. Suffren, she was saying the very same thing and also pointed out how this pattern gets traced back generations.
And that goes back centuries to the white supremacist foundations of our country and the ways that slave owners would regulate the reproduction of enslaved people, especially the women, to reproduce the workforce and then forcibly separate mothers from their children. And the ways that we separated Native families and stole Native children away from their communities and families and placed them with white families. It goes on and on.
So this all kind of makes me think about how, in general, mass incarceration disrupts all three core values of reproductive justice.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, Bavs. We should probably go into some more detail about that and what those are. So do you want to start us off?
Yeah, for sure. So basically, a collective of Black women and women of color called Sister Song came up with the framework of what reproductive justice is. And essentially what that is one, the right to have a child, two is the right not to have a child, and three is the right to parent a child in safety.
Right. So basically that first principle, you know, the one that says that the right to have a child is taken away by mass incarceration, that's like what we saw in Kima's story.
Exactly. Like, just in the way where she was so severely restricted in how she was allowed to spend time with her baby immediately after giving birth.
Yeah, and this right can also be taken away in so many more drastic and obvious ways.
There have been interventions, shall we say, very recently, that have suppressed people's abilities to reproduce. And some of the examples that I'm thinking of are in the California prison system from, I think it was 2005 until 2012. There were over 100 unlawful sterilizations performed on women in the California prison system. Sterilizations where women did not know that they were undergoing surgeries that would prevent them from getting pregnant in the future. Surgeries that that were sterilizing surgeries and that didn't go through the proper channels that the prison system had supposedly set up to try to avoid this. And so that discovery of these unlawful and coercive sterilizations prompted California to pass a law that prohibits sterilization for the purposes of contraception on any individual, male or female, who is incarcerated. That's just California, where some advocacy groups and investigative journalists looked into it. We don't know how often it's happening in other places, but there was a county in Tennessee in 2017 where a sheriff and a judge decided to incentivize females to get Nexplanon contraceptive implants, people in jail, to get Nexplanon contraceptive implants, and for men who were in this jail to get vasectomies. And in exchange, not only would the Nexplanons and vasectomies be free, but in exchange, people would get 30 days off their jail time. So that's sort of a standard textbook definition of coercive, coercive sterilization. So that did not last long once the ACLU found out about it. And there were also recent allegations, although it's still under investigation, but allegations of excessive and unnecessary hysterectomies on women who were at an ICE detention facility in Georgia. So there are a lot of ways in which people's right to have children is being actively suppressed because they are incarcerated.
And so the second principle of reproductive justice, the right not to have a child, is also suppressed.
Yeah, because, you know, even though all of the women in the U.S. have a constitutional right to abortion, it can be quite challenging for incarcerated individuals to access abortion and contraception.
Yeah, exactly. And this is also a much more nuanced topic that Dr. Suffren went into more detail with.
So I want to be clear that any incarcerated person, no matter whether she's in San Francisco, somewhere else in California, or Alabama, incarcerated people retain their constitutional right to abortion. Incarceration does not disrupt that right, and the courts have affirmed that time and again. Now, how that gets actualized, it depends where you are, and which is so surprising, because if it's a right, and if a prison or jail could be sued for denying that right, why does it happen? Well, here we come back to the lack of standards and the lack of oversight. If no one's paying attention, whoever is in charge of that jail and prison can decide what happens. And in subsequent research I've done, we've found that some institutions' written policies expressly do not allow abortion, which is unconstitutional, but no one's paying attention, so it happens. Some prisons and jails don't allow it, but don't have a written policy one way or the other. Some prisons or jails may say it's allowed, but then put up all kinds of barriers like, oh, you have to get a court order to be transported off site because this is not a serious medical need. It's an elective procedure. Or they may require the individual to pay for it herself, and even in some cases to pay for wear and tear on the vehicle of the prison's vehicle that transports her, or overtime for the guards, all these things that may that put up functional barriers.
And then the third principle of reproductive justice, the one that's the right to parent a child in safety, that's definitely disrupted by mass incarceration. And this is through the literal separation of parents from their children
exactly.
Once they get incarcerated.
Yeah, yeah. And even more than that, once an individual is behind bars for a certain amount of time, what is it, like 15 months or 18 months?
I think that's right. It varies state by state.
Right, yeah. So after that certain allocated time of passes, incarcerated individuals can actually lose their parental custody rights entirely.
Yeah, and beyond that literal separation, that right is also being disrupted by broader structural issues.
Broader structural issues, the ways that we overinvest in our system of incarceration, as well as community policing, rather than investing in strengthening our social safety nets, our healthcare safety nets, investing in education, investing in dismantling white supremacist structures that would allow people to have, especially Black and brown people and poor communities, that might allow them to have more stability. So all the ways that we have resources funneled into our system of incarceration rather than social systems that might actually help people thrive.
So even when it comes to factors like social and healthcare safety nets, That speaks to another concept Dr. Suffren uses called the intimacy of jail, which is a term about the relationships that are formed between people in a jail.
For a lot of people, coming to jail is not a disruptive moment. It's something that has happened to them since they were 18.
And the reasons why people keep coming back to jail repeatedly is because of the lack of social safety nets being provided in communities. Sometimes individuals are incarcerated for crimes that they haven't committed, or sometimes it's for minor reasons that speak more towards the lack of resources afforded to them that keep them safe.
So things like unstable housing and having not enough money to survive, and so exchanging sex for food or drugs or money. Kima, one of her many incarcerations in jail, and at the time I met her, she'd been in jail almost 80 times in her adult life, and she was in her early 30s. One of the times that she was in jail during the time I came to know her was for shoplifting some Dove soap at a CVS. Sometimes, you know, for shoplifting diapers. And I'm not saying that everybody should be shoplifting. I'm saying that people, especially in some cases, Black women who for whom the state is already regulating and controlling their families, and other people whose lives are shaped by economic insecurity, sometimes the reasons that they're in the criminal legal system are more related to that than they are to them being hardened criminals and threats to society. And so things don't change when they get released. It's not like they are going to a society with a robust safety net that is no longer racist, that is no longer characterized by gender-based discrimination. They're going back to that same society. And so those same oppressive structures are going to keep them in the system. So they keep going to, I don't want to say going, that makes it sound volitional. They are trapped in these systems that keep them going in and out of jail. And so it becomes just another day. And I don't want to trivialize it or minimize it, because it is still a big deal. But it just becomes so folded into their daily rhythms that they come to know the people who work in jail. They come to know other people who are also coming in and out of that jail. Some of them may have grown up with some of the people who work at the jail, you know, because jails are local, right? So you go to a jail and the people who work there are also from the community where you live. And so there can be some familiarity. And I know, you know, some of the nurses, the healthcare providers, the deputies, they came to know many of the women who were coming in and out of this jail, and vice versa. Sometimes they would sit together and play cards. It doesn't happen often, and I'm sure that would be discouraged. But, you know, and I witnessed a woman who was experiencing a traumatic miscarriage, and one of the guards was the one who was providing her emotional support, and she appreciated it. And the guard was crying along with her. And so there's this intimacy of sharing the space, of sharing the chronicity of being in jail, and the familiarity that comes with that.
Okay, so we have the system of mass incarceration that is filled with contradictions. Because incarceration disproportionately impacts those who are poor and who are of color, many of those who are incarcerated do not come from backgrounds of reliable healthcare. So, incarceration provides them with this right. But simultaneously, it strips away many of their other rights, such as the right to freedom. And while it does provide this broad right to healthcare, the way that this care is executed is highly variable, meaning that sometimes care may be good and sometimes care may be horrible. And for incarcerated pregnant women, they may be receiving some form of maternal health care, but the same exact system is stripping them of their right to reproductive justice.
Yeah, and so with all of this, I'm still left with the second part of my initial question. To what extent is this system even responsible for providing adequate health care?
Mm-hmm. And I also want to add to that, who else may have this responsibility? I mean, is it just the broader criminal legal system or individuals as well, like healthcare providers?
Well, these are state and taxpayer funded institutions. And so, you know, they have to provide for everything for this person, including their healthcare. And they should also organize systems of mandatory standards and oversight. That doesn't mean it has to be the federal government going from prison to prison, making sure they're following those standards. There are ways, you know, other systems in place, similar to like the Joint Commission or JCO that accredits hospitals. And, you know, in order to receive Medicare and Medicaid funding, you have to be accredited by JCO and meet their standards. You know, some system like that needs to be in place. So it is absolutely the responsibility of the state to ensure that standards of care are met and that systems of accountability are in place. In terms of the responsibility of individual healthcare providers, you know, I'm a physician, and when I graduated from medical school, I took an oath, a Hippocratic oath, and that applies to all patients. And so it's incumbent upon the healthcare provider, you know, to provide healthcare to their patients. But they can only do so within the what the systems allow. So a person who is, you know, working at a prison that doesn't, I don't know, that doesn't have a colposcope, how can they ensure that a woman with an abnormal pap smear has the appropriate follow-up for her cervical dysplasia? Okay, maybe they don't have a colposcope at the prison. That healthcare system, and it's not necessarily incumbent on an individual physician, because there should be a system in place for that patient to go to a gynecologist or women's health practitioner in the community to get a colposcopy. But it is the responsibility of the healthcare providers who work in prisons and jails to treat patients compassionately, to treat them as patients, and, you know, and to provide community standard of care.
So, Dr. Suffren, I think really for our final question, in your opinion and based on your experiences, what is your vision for reshaping the criminal legal system?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that question. I very much support efforts to reshape our criminal legal system. And here's where I want to bring COVID up for a moment, too. There have been a lot of efforts to decrease the number of people behind bars as an infection control measure. I say a lot. There haven't been enough. But there have been some efforts recognizing that the overcrowded conditions are one big contributor to outbreaks inside prisons and jails. Mm-hmm. And people are calling this decarceration. And in my mind, it's not decarceration. It's depopulation. You're decreasing mm-hmm. the number of bodies in these confined spaces. Decarceration is about changing the entire mindset, the entire purpose, and the ways that our society over-relies on incarceration as a means of racialized and social and economic control. Mm-hmm. That is not what is happening right now. Certainly the depopulation because of COVID paves the way for it potentially, but it is not fundamentally about reshaping our society's reliance on law enforcement and incarceration.
Right.
I think we, you know, only need to look at the examples of how, you know, the different ways that Black Lives Matter protests over the summer of 2020 were policed compared to the ways that the attack and the insurrection on our Capitol, which was mostly white men, the ways that those situations were differentially handled by law enforcement. We have not decarcerated. We have not changed the racially segregated and overly criminalizing ways that we organize our society. So I very much support decarceration efforts and reshaping what incarceration does and does not do. How to make that part happen is not my area of expertise, but mm-hmm. I want to lift up the work of so many colleagues and organizations that do that work. I mean, there are some things that I think are obvious, changing mandatory minimum sentences, a lot of the draconian policies of the so-called war on drugs, mm-hmm. Not necessarily only because of drug-related charges, but because all other sentences for other charges also became more stringent and longer because of the policies of the war on drugs. So changing sentencing laws, bail reform, so many people are in jail because they can't afford their bail.
Yeah.
The majority of people in our nation's jails are there pretrial. They haven't even been convicted of a crime. So we need bail reform that doesn't punish people for being poor. Those are just some things. And investing in alternatives to incarceration, especially for pregnant people and especially for mothers. And it also needs to happen in the way that our society approaches Black and brown youth. My colleague at Hopkins, Veshla Weaver, does really important research on the hyper-policing of youth in communities of color, and the way that that starts, it starts and paves the way for them to be incarcerated as their adults. So we also need to change the way our police are involved in communities and especially with youth.
Yeah.
While we're working on those bigger goals, we also need urgent reform in the healthcare systems behind bars. Mm-hmm. And I feel very strongly that you can work on both simultaneously, and that investing in quality healthcare services for incarcerated people does not mean you're trying to make the system, you know, better and strengthen the system. You're just trying to treat people like they're humans and provide them the healthcare they need. So what do we need for that to happen? We need mandatory standards, and that may look a little different for jails and prisons, but we need mandatory standards of healthcare services that prisons and jails must provide. We need a system of accountability. And so that could look like mandatory accreditation, for instance. And one way to tie accreditation and make it mandatory is to tie it to funding. And probably the most direct way to do that would be to lift the so-called inmate exclusion of Medicaid. So incarcerated people cannot use, and facilities cannot use, Medicaid and Medicare funding that was written into the Social Security Act of 1965 that established Medicaid and Medicare. It explicitly excludes incarcerated people. So we need to lift that so that prisons and jails can actually use Medicaid and Medicare funds. And then, you know, if they don't follow the standards and don't, you know, are held accountable, they don't get their Medicaid reimbursement. So I think those are some steps. And within that, we need to make sure especially that women's healthcare and reproductive healthcare is standardized and that people have access to full scope pregnancy care that includes abortion, prenatal care, postpartum care, safe and respectful birth, access to contraception, non-coercive contraception, reversible contraception, not sterilization, access to drug treatment programs, maintaining family bonds, all of those things.
Okay, so what are our main takeaways for this episode?
One, incarcerated individuals have a constitutional right to healthcare, but how that healthcare is administered varies across institutions. Meaning it differs between federal and state prisons, prisons and jails, etc. And when it comes to jails, we don't even know how many jails exist and know even less about what goes on inside.
Two, jail is a place that punishes. However, it can also be a place that's depended on for healthcare, or even a place to sleep. And this speaks to a broader issue concerning the failure of many social and health safety nets that exist outside of these facilities.
And three, the relationship between mass incarceration and healthcare is full of contradictions, especially when it comes to reproductive justice, because although some incarcerated pregnant women may be able to access care for their reproductive health in institutions like jail that they wouldn't otherwise have, it is a contradictory relationship in that incarceration disrupts all three principles of reproductive justice. Meaning the right to motherhood, to have children, or to not have children, all of those are typically stripped away from them.
All right, so before we wrap up, it's time for some icebreakers with Dr. Suffren.
Let's do it.
Cue the music. So, Dr. Suffren, for the first question, what would the title of your autobiography be?
I don't know. Maybe I'll answer for what my partner might say it would be, which would be Chascona, which Ooh. Is actually a nickname that Pablo Neruda had for one of his wives who had hair that's kind of like mine. We're on a podcast, so people can't see what I look like. I have curly brown hair that's often very tangled, and that's what Chascona, sort of referring to a web kind of mess of matted hair. Mm-hmm. And I would like to think of some of the energy that I bring to what I do as being embracing of all those tangles and trying to sort through them.
Wow. I really love that answer. That's so symbolic and so meaningful.
Yeah. That's so good.
So for our second question, what is the best coast, east or west?
Can't choose one. I've lived on both, and there are wonderful things about them both. I love the West Coast and its proximity to open air and nature and everything we do. And but I also feel very much at home on the East Coast as well.
Yeah, so. That's very fair.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think I really love the East Coast, but I'm really hoping to explore the West Coast more someday. Okay, so for our last question, what's your favorite time of the day and why?
That has varied over the course of my life. I would say right now it's early morning before my children wake up and I have quiet time to myself.
Yeah, definitely got to optimize on the quiet time.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. Well, that's all that we had for you today.
Great.
Dr. Suffren, thank you so, so much for joining us and for sharing your expertise with us. I know that we learned so much throughout the entirety of this episode, and we're so excited for it to come out.
Thank you so much. It was great chatting with you, and thank you for the very incisive and thoughtful questions.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. Next time, we'll be discussing the idea of growing up in prison and the kind of health impacts that has. Until then.
Women's Health Incarcerated can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. To view our transcripts, learn more information about the intersection between the incarceration system and healthcare, or find different ways that you could get involved, please visit www.winkthemovement.org. That's www.whincthemovement.org.